The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition for this week. Due to Jim doing some traveling, I think he's in the plane right now, if you will, or on his way. I'll be flying solo today, so I thought we'd take this opportunity to do something we mentioned a couple, 2-3 weeks ago on the show that we hadn't done for a while. This is certainly a topic, that being Social Security, that we have covered quite a lot on the show. We get a lot of questions on a regular basis about Social Security, but we haven't really done a, I don't know if I'd call this basics of Social Security, but the show is kind of things everyone should know about Social Security itself. I'm going to resist getting too far off into the weeds or down rabbit holes on some of the minutia or details of some of the calculations or things like that. I want to keep it at a a fairly high level of to be able to touch on all the things that people should know about the basics of Social Security itself. And then we'll use follow-up questions that people might send in or other opportunities to dig down deeper into some of these elements on other shows, which we tend to do. So I think we've been, over the past few years, mostly dealing with some of the specific minutiae here and there, but haven't honestly talked about these kind of overarching basics. So that's what today's show is going to be. And so I'll dig right in and say that first, that Social Security is a pretty simple program as far as its structure. It's a funds transfer system, if you will. It's not a retirement account that you're amassing. You're participating in a system where your contributions as a worker, we'll call them contributions, although it's a tax, as we all know. It's a tax on your wages, that you're going to send money into the system while you're working, and that money isn't now tagged to you, really. They keep track of what you've put in there for future calculation purposes, but there's no account with your name on it that money goes into, because that money is being paid out essentially immediately to those who are claiming Social Security benefits. So this is how the system was structured initially. If it was an account that had to amass some value before it paid out to you, then people would have paid in for decades before anything were to flow out. So when they started Social Security back in the 1930s, that it would have been 30, 40 years before anybody would have gotten any money out of it, and that wasn't the purpose of the program. So they designed it very differently. So keep that in mind. And just some basic statistics, as of this year, about 176 million people worked and paid into Social Security, and about 65 million people are receiving monthly Social Security benefits of all different kinds. So that's a ratio of about 2.7 to 1. So this ratio has been going down over time as the number of workers versus the number of benefit recipients has changed over time. And that does put some pressure or stresses on the system. The fewer people paying in per person receiving benefits makes the math that more challenging to work. So that's part of what's contributing to this threat, I'll call it, on Social Security as far as we how we understand it to work today. There's going to have to be some adjustments made to the system over the coming 10, 12 years. And one key element is the fact that there's fewer workers per benefit recipient in the whole system. So the taxes that you pay in, I called them contributions before, but they're taxes, as we all know. You put in 6.2% and your employer puts in 6.2% unless you're self-employed and you put in both sides, the 12.4%. Some people might say, no, it's you've got 7.65% coming out. I can see it on my pay stub. Well, 6.2 goes to Social Security. The other 1.45% from you and your employer go to Medicare. I'm not going to really be talking about Medicare today. So that's what's going into the system. And of those dollars that go in, about 85 cents of every dollar is going to Social Security, retirement benefits, surviving spouse benefits, children of workers who have died benefits. Those types of benefits make up the vast majority of what those taxes are going towards, and about 15 cents on the dollar goes into the pool that funds people with disabilities and their families. So there's kind of two trust funds, we call it. The disability side gets about 15 cents on the dollar of those taxes we pay in, and the other 85 cents goes into the more traditional retirement, survivor, spousal, child benefits that we're all familiar with. And of the of that money we pay in, there's some overhead. So I like to point out that Social Security, believe it or not, even though it's a federal program, is actually pretty efficient as far as the cost to implement the system. For the vast sums of money that flow through there, there's just not a whole lot that are that's shaved off in overhead, less than one penny on a dollar. So less than 1% covers all the operating costs of the Social Security Administration to administer all this kind of stuff. So kudos to them. We'd always prefer it be lower, and I think they're always trying to make it lower. But it's not as cumbersome and inefficient as a lot of people would assume being a government program. So your Social Security number, you all listening probably have a Social Security number. Attached on that, attached to your card is that number. And most of you could probably go lay your hands on your card. Just a quick fun fact about your Social Security number and card. If you lose it, you want to get a new one. Most of the time, you can just request it online. Not all the time, but most of the time you can. As long as there's no information change going on, you can request one online through ssa.gov is the website. You've got to set up an account there if you don't have it already. But beware, you should be careful with your card because there are limits on how often you can get a replacement. You can just for, security of the system, if you will, they limit your replacements to a maximum of 3 per year. That would be a very disorganized year if you lose 3 in a year, but a maximum of 10 in a lifetime. So if you aren't good at keeping track of things, I could see where you could burn through that 10 in a lifetime. Just know that those limits, the 3 per year or 10 in a lifetime, it doesn't count when you do a name change, like if you get married or something like that, or some kind of status change. Those don't count if it's really just a replacement of a lost card. So make sure you keep track of those. You become eligible for Social Security by working and paying your taxes, that 6.2% that I mentioned before, and plus the 6.2% that your employer puts in. And you're going to participate in the system and earn credits, they call it. Sometimes they're called quarters because you can earn up to 4 per year. And in 2022, when I'm recording this, to earn a credit, you have to earn $1,510. So essentially $6,040 in a year will get you your 4 credits. So you don't have to earn a whole lot in a year to earn these credits. And you're going to need... Most people are going to need 40 credits to become eligible for benefits. I'll mention now that a lot of the things I'm going to state is kind of the standard numbers and figures and facts. Many times there are one-off little exceptions that apply to a very small group of people. I'm not going to go off into every single exception. But for the most part, you can assume you need to earn 40 credits, which, since they limit your acquisition of these credits to 4 per year, it's going to take you 10 years of work in order to qualify for benefits. You're not going to have a big benefit at that time because they're going to use 35 years of your earnings history in order to determine your benefit. But 10 opens the door, cracks it open a little bit, and now you've got benefits that you can actually receive within the Social Security system. Those benefits can come in the form of, you know, the one we all think about, retirement benefits. And these are meant, obviously, for retirement. So they've established kind of when you can claim these benefits. You can claim these benefits as early as age 62. But what's called your full retirement age is where you get what they refer to as your full benefit. And the full retirement age has, you know, started at a lower age when the system first fired up. But ever since 1943, birth year of 1943, the full retirement age has been increased from its starting point. It was 66 for the longest time for those born between 1943 and 1954. And then there's this period from 1955 through 1960 birth years that they have slowly raised the full retirement age. So 1955, 66 and 2 months is your full retirement age. And then it goes up 66 and 4 months, 6 months, 8 months, etc. every year until you hit 1960, where full retirement age is 67. So for those born 1960 or later, your full retirement age is 67. Why is that important? Well, your full retirement age is kind of what determines your base retirement benefit amount. And then the calculations where they will reduce your benefit for claiming earlier or increase your benefit for claiming later than your full retirement age all key off of that full retirement age that I just quoted, which people listening is going to be somewhere between 66 and 67. So what does happen if you delay, if you wait? And right now there's a crediting process called delayed retirement credits, where for every month past your full retirement age that you wait before you claim, they're going to increase your benefit that you otherwise would have received by claiming at your full retirement age. They're going to increase it by 2/3% for each month that you delay. And I'm saying it that way. Most people hear discussions about this as the 8% per year delayed retirement credits. And that is true, that if you delay for a year, it is 8%. 2/3% times 12 is 8. But I want to make it clear that you earn these credits actually on a monthly basis. You don't have to wait a full year and then it jumps up by 8%. It literally is a monthly accrual of these credits. And these credits can accrue up until age 70. After that, you no longer get any delayed retirement credits added to your record. So that's why we say there's no reason to delay claiming after age 70. That's as big as your benefit will be. And if you don't claim, you're just leaving money on the table. By the way, they're not going to chase you down to try to pay you. If you never apply for benefits, you're never going to receive benefits. I have actually run across people, not many, that were well past age 70 that never claimed a benefit. Maybe they falsely assumed they didn't have a benefit, or it slipped their mind, or whatever the reason. It's not very common, but I've actually seen that, and they weren't being paid a benefit. And they won't make you whole, if you will. There's a bit of a look back period, if you will. They'll retroactively pay you up to 6 months worth of benefits. But if you were to wait till 80 before you claim, you're going to lose 9.5 years worth of benefits, just so you know. That's delaying. If you claim early, so prior to your full retirement age, they're going to reduce your benefit under kind of a wonky formula. But Social Security, in their paperwork, when they're trying to keep things simple, describe it as they're going to reduce your benefits by about 0.5% for each month you claim earlier than your full retirement age. And that's about is correct. It is about 0.5% per month. It's a little more than that for the first 3 years that you're claiming early, and a little less than 0.5% per month for any years above 3 years prior to your full retirement age that you're claiming. So you have, you know, a bit of control over what your monthly benefit's going to be, not just through your earnings record, but through the date that you actually claim. Now, big question always is, can I still work while I'm receiving benefits? Absolutely, you can. The question is going to be, will it affect your Social Security benefit if you're also claiming Social Security? Well, here's another. Not only do you receive a reduced benefit by claiming before your full retirement age, you also are subject to what's called the earnings test if you're working and claiming Social Security prior to your full retirement age. And they have a formula where they will reduce your Social Security benefit if your earnings exceed a certain amount per year. So in all the years prior to your full retirement age year, if you earn, and these limits change, so I'm going to give you the 2022 figure, over $19,560 in a year, they're going to reduce your Social Security benefit that you might be simultaneously claiming $1 for every $2 you go over that $19,560. So you can earn up to $19,560 and have no effect on your Social Security benefit directly. In the year you turn your full retirement age, so they give you kind of an extra cushion, if you will, in the year that you turn your full retirement age, they aren't going to reduce your Social Security benefit for earnings unless you make more than $51,960 in, this is 2022 dollars. And then they're going to reduce it $1 for every $3 you go over that. So the year in which you turn your full retirement age, things get a lot more relaxed, all the way up until the month you hit your full retirement age. And at that point, it's a free-for-all. You can earn as much as you want after that, and there's no effect on your Social Security benefit. So reaching full retirement age does a couple things. It allows you to claim a benefit that is unreduced, and if you delay past that, can actually increase due to those delayed retirement credits. And reaching full retirement age allows you to escape the earnings test. You can then earn as much as you want. What is earnings? That's always a critical part. People get confused as to what's going to count towards this earnings test figure. Well, it's wages from work or self-employment net income is what this is going to be. So since most people are you know, working for an employer, it's wages from work. It does not, the earnings that they include in that 19,560 figure that I mentioned before, or the 51,960, it's not pension income or annuity income or retirement plan distributions from 401ks or IRAs. Not dividends, interest, or capital gains. All those things are taxable income. Those are not wages from work. So when they're talking about earnings here for the earnings test, it really should be the wages from work test is kind of the way you should think about it. Other sources of income will not count towards this earnings limit that could reduce your Social Security benefit if you're claiming prior to your full retirement age and continuing to work. So, yeah, that one is commonly confused as to exactly how that works. And I hear all the time people are worried that their pension or other, you know, distributions from retirement accounts or what have you will affect their Social Security benefit. And it doesn't directly. And I'm going to tell you why I'm saying that here in just a minute. In addition to your own retirement benefits, there's also retirement benefits for widows and widowers. We oftentimes call those survivor benefits. And there's disability benefits, which I'm not going to get into today. That's kind of a discussion unto itself. But the next question that comes up constantly is, are your Social Security benefits taxable, and how do they figure that out? Well, statistics tell us about 40% of current Social Security beneficiaries pay taxes on their benefits. So that number was much lower earlier, back in the 1980s when they first put forth taxability of Social Security benefits. Prior to that, they weren't taxable. 1980s it started, and then they added to that taxable status in the 1990s. But currently, if you've got earnings, we'll call it, or you know, taxable income of a certain type, it's a very specific formula, is why I'm kind of being hesitant here. As an individual, if you're filing an individual tax return, if your total income, they call it, is more than $25,000, you're going to pay taxes on some of your Social Security. Not all of the Social Security, but some of it. You never pay taxes on all your Social Security. The most that you can have subjected to taxation is 85% of your Social Security. But for an individual, the first up to $25,000 of total income, their Social Security is not taxed at all. Once they go over $25,000, then up to 50%, and when I say up to, it's because there's a formula involved, but you can kind of in your mind just assume 50% is worst case, up to taxable income of $34,000. And if you're over $34,000 in this combined taxable income category, that 85% comes into play, and up to 85% of your Social Security becomes taxable. For a joint filer, between you and your spouse filing jointly, those limits or triggers are $32,000, triggers that 50% threshold, and then $44,000 of combined taxable income for a joint filer is where we start seeing the up to 85% of your Social Security becoming taxable. So when I said before that earnings wouldn't directly affect your Social Security benefit, if you aren't affected by the earnings test, right? If you don't trigger the earnings test, earnings can contribute, if you will, to the taxation of your Social Security. So it's kind of a form of a reduction to your Social Security if you think about it. If you could otherwise have received it tax-free or at a lower tax rate or lower taxable effect, and earnings from work or other places pushes you into more taxation in your Social Security, that's kind of, in effect, an indirect reduction of your Social Security. So that's why I mentioned or was careful to say there's no direct reduction due to earnings unless you trigger the earnings test. Secondary or related question to this is, what goes into this taxable income figure to determine these thresholds? Well, it's your AGI without the Social Security in it, plus you have to add back in any tax-exempt income and any foreign income you earned that was excluded on your return, and then 50% of your Social Security benefit. Those all added together, if they exceed that $25,000 for an individual or $32,000 for a joint filer, some of your Social Security is going to be taxed at the federal level. States vary from state to state. I can't go through the list because it's broad. Some states don't tax at all. Some states don't tax income of any kind at all. Some states, even if they tax other income, they don't tax Social Security or some other retirement income. And some states have special rules, like certain amounts are excluded. So they kind of partially tax Social Security, and some states tax all of it to the extent that the feds tax it. So I'm not going to go into the states beyond that. Beyond your own benefit, there's also benefits for your family that get unlocked once you're earning those. You know, you get those 40 credits in place. When you start receiving your benefits, that unlocks the door essentially to these auxiliary benefits for family members. And family members can also be eligible if they are your spouse and if they're age 62 or older themselves. So just because you are receiving, your spouse has to also be 62 or older, or at any age if they're caring for your child that's under the age of 16 or that child has a disability. So we've talked about child in care benefits on previous shows. That's some of the shows that get into kind of the weeds. That's what they're talking about here. They overlook that age 62 requirement for your spouse if your spouse is caring for your child. Not only is your spouse going to get a benefit, your child themselves is going to qualify for a benefit. If the child is unmarried, younger than 18 or younger than 19, but still in school full time in, you know, not college, but in elementary or high school, or age 18 or older if they have a qualifying disability that started before age 22. So some people have the unfortunate case of having a child that became disabled while still a child, essentially. So they're never going to establish their own work record. They can receive benefits on your record if that disability happened before the age of 22. So you might have, now hopefully only have one spouse, but you could have many children, right, that fall under this category, unmarried, younger than 18 or younger than 19 in high school, etc. There are limits. So what's called the family maximum comes into play. So typically these benefit recipients, if you will, the spouse and the children, can receive half of your full retirement age benefit. And, you know, you could imagine if you had many kids, that seems like a whole bunch as a total benefit, a total family benefit, but they cap the family benefit at between 150 and 180% of your own full retirement age benefit. So keep in mind, there are, even though you might have multiple people that could claim on your benefits once you are on your record, once you claim your own benefit, there are limits. And 150 to 180% based on a formula that I'm not going to go into. I promised I'd stay out of the weeds. And that includes yours. So essentially, yours is going to be 100. And then another 50 to 80% can be paid out to any number of qualifying family members. What if you're divorced? Well, if you're divorced, an ex-spouse might still qualify for benefits on your record if they meet certain requirements. If you were married for at least 10 years and they measure it to the anniversary date, it isn't calendar years, it's actually to your anniversary. You have to make it to your 10th anniversary. They forego the requirement that you have claimed your own benefit to unlock these other benefits if you've been divorced for at least 2 years. So this is actually a case where divorced spouses have a little more relaxed rules than married couples. Still have to be 62 as a divorced spouse to receive benefits and be unmarried. If you remarry, spousal benefits go away. That is not, we'll talk about survivor benefits and a special age rule here next, but for spousal benefits, if you remarry, even if you've been married for 10 years to your first spouse, divorced, if you remarry, spousal benefit disappears from that original spouse, and now you're connected to the new spouse that you chose to marry. Survivor benefits happen a little bit differently. If you're still married, essentially family members can collect, if you pass away, your spouse, if they're 60 or older, so here's a time where the age of 62 doesn't come into play. 62 is where these retirement, spousal benefits, etc. come in. For widow, widower benefits, survivor benefits, I usually call them, 60 or older, standard, or as young as 50, if the surviving spouse is disabled, or at any age, if they're caring for a child younger than the age of 16, there's that child in care benefit as well. So you can actually be receiving survivor benefits from your deceased spouse's record, even if you're way below 50, even. You could be in your 20s, 30s, 40s. And receive, as long as you're caring for the child of that deceased person, they waive the age requirement for survivor benefits. Children can also receive these survivor benefits. Same rules as when you're alive. Essentially, they have to be younger than 18 or younger than 19 and still in high school full time, or have a qualifying disability that happened before the age of 22. One thing to note is that the survivor benefits for children is 75% of your benefit rather than 50%. They actually pay a higher percentage for in a survivorship case than in a while you're still living an auxiliary benefit case. Same thing with a spouse, right? A spouse gets 50% while you're alive, but if you pass away, they're entitled to 100% of your benefit with, you know, reductions applied if they claim at a younger age than is considered full retirement age, but still they could get up to 100% of what you were receiving, whereas a spousal benefit, it's limited to half of what your full retirement age benefit was going to be. One-off, specifically, not just a one-off fun fact, but a one-time payment at death, there's a one-time $255 payment. This used to contribute more towards your burial costs and those sorts of things. They haven't increased this number. I don't have the year in front of me, but it's been a very, very, very long time. But there is, in addition to these survivor benefits that can be unlocked if you were to pass away, there is a one-time lump sum payment paid to your spouse or minor children if they meet certain requirements. If you're divorced and survivorship is an issue, so you're divorced and a spouse passes away, the same rule applies where as long as you had been married for 10 years, you're treated as if you were still married. You're at least 60 years old to claim survivor benefits, just as if you were married, that same rule. You've got that age 50 if with a qualifying disability. Could be at any age if you're caring for a child under the age of 16, just like before, and not be currently married unless the remarriage occurred after age 60 or after age 50, if you have a qualifying disability. So there's that carve-out, that special carve-out that doesn't apply to spousal benefits when you're divorced, but does apply to survivor benefits. If you were married for 10 years and divorced, if your spouse passes away, as long as you didn't remarry prior to the age of 60, you still are entitled to claim survivor benefits on that previous spouse's record. And this was essentially put in place years ago so that seniors that might have lost a spouse who wanted to remarry could do so without having to worry about losing access to maybe a better survivor benefit. Maybe they really relied on it. Say they were a stay-at-home spouse, don't have much of their own record, so they're really relying on that survivor benefit from their ex-spouse, and they have now found someone else, would like to get married, and under the old rules, if they were to do that, they would lose that survivor benefit. So there were a bunch of seniors that just didn't get married without because of this financial hit they were going to take. So this was a carve-out rule applying just to survivor benefits alone. So you're not forced to take them if your new spouse provides you with better benefits than your ex-spouse did. You can certainly always opt for that as long as you qualify, but it's you won't lose it as long as you don't remarry before the age of 60. For most people, that's the rule. If you happen to be disabled, the age is 50, so there's that little carve out additionally at a younger age for those folks. How much survivor benefit you get, I already mentioned that it's going to range from 75 to 100% instead of that 50% that you'd receive as a spouse or child when the benefit recipient is still alive. Big issue people face is, you know, how do I figure out how much I'm going to get and how do I actually claim the benefit? So when you're ready to apply, the general rule that Social Security recommends is that you consider applying for benefits about 4 months before the date that you want your benefits to start. Mentioned before that they're pretty efficient as far as, you know, the cost to run the program, but it still takes some time to get everything processed and set up in the system ready to start making your payments. So don't hold off to the last minute. The good news is if you do wait, you say don't go in proactively or don't contact them, maybe if it's even through the website to turn on your benefit, early enough for them to start at the month you want, they will start it up for you and play catch up. They'll go ahead and get you entered, and as soon as the payment starts, if they missed any, they'll suddenly lump sum pay any missed benefits for the month or two that they might have missed because you didn't apply quite early enough. So, but that's the general rule. People ask that all the time. When should I claim? How early should I claim? About 4 months is their guidance directly from their info. What you need to apply is going to vary a little bit. It kind of depends on how much they know about you. If you've already set up your account, they kind of clearly understand your identity and have you in the system prior. But the types of information that you might need to sign up if they don't have everything already in there, your Social Security card, or at least the number, your birth certificate. If you're claiming for children, the children's birth certificates and Social Security numbers, your spouse's birth certificate, maybe if you're applying for benefits based on their earnings, a marriage certificate. If you're signing up on spouse's earnings, maybe they don't have the information that you're connected in the system as spouses, and you might have to prove that if you're claiming some type of spousal benefit. And information about marriage and divorce dates themselves, if you are trying to claim a divorced spousal benefit, those types of things. So they'll, and they need to see originals pretty much with these documents. They will return them, but a photocopy is not going to cut it. You're going to have to supply those. So this is another reason why you should claim, say, 4 months early. Because if they do need some additional documentation, then you still have time to supply it, get it down to your local Social Security office, or mail it in. A lot of people prefer to set up an appointment and go in so they don't have to send their important documents through the mail back and forth. But a lot of people making a simple claim can do it online, especially if you've set up your account, you've already proved your identity, etc., and you're not asking them to send payments to a strange place, or you're not acting, changing your address and then suddenly claiming. Those are triggers they're looking for someone pretending to be you. So as long as your claim is pretty simple and straightforward, you can do it online. If there's additional information needed, they'll let you know. And that's why that four-month period is so important, is you want to have plenty of time to get all your ducks in a row. Once they've got you in the system and they start paying you, you must receive your Social Security payments electronically. There's no more paper checks being mailed. I don't think anybody is, at this point in time, still grandfathered in to paper checks. I think those are gone. The most common way is a direct deposit into your bank account, and they'll collect that information from you. If you don't have an account at a financial institution and you want to receive benefits on a prepaid debit card, they do have that option. It's called a Direct Express card, and they'll put those payments right on that, and then you just use it as a debit card. And then they also have another electronic transfer account that's a federally insured account set up for people who don't have either of those other two options. I haven't ever run into anybody using one of those, so I'm not sure the pros and cons. It doesn't sound very easy and straightforward. So I would say for most people, they're going to use that direct deposit into their checking account. I'll add that the timing of the payments, you're paid in arrears, which means a month after the benefit is earned. So if you are owed a benefit for the month of May, for instance, that deposit will be made or given to you in June each year. So they're a month in arrears, a month behind. And the day of the month that you receive benefits, they're paid, essentially they're set up or programmed in the system every Wednesday. The first Wednesday of the month is mostly for SSI payments, so the supplemental payments for low-income folks, and some other one-off types of payments generally happen on the first Wednesday of the month. Retirement and standard Social Security benefits go out on the second, third, and fourth Wednesday of the month, and which one you get is determined by the day of the month that you were born. If you were born in the first 10 days of the month, the 1st through the 10th, you're going to get your benefit payment on the second Wednesday of the month. If you were born between the 11th and 20th, you're going to receive it on the third Wednesday of the month. And those born in the last third of the month get their payment the fourth Wednesday of the month as direct deposited into your account. So just so you know how those actually flow out and work. So those, you know, I think even if you kind of knew how Social Security worked, hopefully there were a couple little tidbits in there you found interesting. I'm not going to dig into, you know, how your benefit is actually calculated. We've done shows on that. We cover those questions pretty frequently. If, you know, enough people are clamoring for a tutorial on what goes into your AMI, average indexed monthly earnings, how they calculate that, how that leads to your PIA or primary insurance amount, how they apply cost of living adjustments, all those types of details. I can, you know, certainly go into those in the future. We generally are dealing with those types of topics on those weekly questions that we get because people are confused by those, you know, those details of how things are calculated, how two benefits for maybe two different spouses could be coordinated because of this and that and these variables. So we get into some of that typically, but I wanted to get everybody up to speed, especially if you were a new listener to the podcast, understand Social Security itself. It's become more and more important for folks in that it is unique for many of you out there, unique in that you many now in the United States don't have any other inflation-adjusted lifetime income source naturally available to them other than Social Security. Back in the day, there was a lot of people that had lifetime income sources in the form of traditional pensions where you still continue to essentially collect a salary. You just didn't have to go to work anymore. That was kind of what an old-fashioned defined benefit pension was, and many people had those. And even when there was Social Security, they'd have both of those things together. Nowadays, it's becoming more and more rare to have one of those style of pensions. Most people have either a pension or retirement account that is in the form of a lump sum amount that isn't the same as a lifetime income stream. A lump sum amount you can outlive. A lifetime income stream you cannot. So don't dismiss the value of Social Security. For many people, their Social Security benefit, if we look at what lump sum equivalent it would take to generate the same payments as Social Security, they'll find that the Social Security income stream is at or above the value of their other saved assets. For some people, for some reason, people look at Social Security as, oh, this little thing off to the side, it's not worth this, that, and the other thing. It's very powerful as a foundational element to most people's retirement plans, and for the vast majority of people, they have a Social Security benefit, either under their own record or under a spouse's record. If you don't have Social Security, you're going to have some type of alternative. If you're, you know, if you're a worker in the United States over a period of time, you're going to employers can't just opt out of using Social Security without supplying something in return. Some employers out there, what qualifies as what you get instead is actually not very attractive, honestly. But most are pretty good replacements. If not, you know, people, if they look at them side by side, might have even opted for the alternative rather than Social Security had they had that choice at their employer. But don't dismiss the value of Social Security. It is very powerful in creating a lifetime income stream that's inflation adjusted. And that's the key. The inflation adjustment that they apply to this easily doubles or more the value of the Social Security income stream compared to an income stream that's flat. So I'm a fan, you know. Is it a perfect system? No. Does it have issues that need to be worked on and adjusted? Absolutely. I'm a fan because there's no other thing like it that such a wide swath of people in this country have access to. And almost everyone needs this base amount, unless you're, you know, there's a certain amount of wealth that gets you to the point where you don't care about this, where Social Security is not consequential. But for the majority of people in this country, Social Security is going to create either a substantial part of their overall retirement resources, or at least a significant foundation upon which other things can be built. So making decisions on Social Security is very important. A couple other things I'll leave you with. deciding on how to claim and when to claim Social Security is very important because it's a one-time decision. It's very difficult to do have a do-over anymore. The do-over is very restricted. Let's say you claimed and then you decided that was a mistake. You'd rather do it differently or at a later time. You can what's called withdraw your application for benefits, but you're limited to doing that once in a lifetime, and it has to be within 12 months of you claiming, and you have to pay back all the money that they've paid you and any others who are claiming on your record during that time period. So it's difficult to pull off. And if you've gone beyond that year, you're now stuck for sure. Or if maybe you haven't gone throughout that year and you don't have the money to pay it back, you can't undo it either. So make sure you have your ducks in a row and you know how the Social Security fits into your overall plan before you claim. Do not, it's such an important decision. Don't make it frivolously. Be well informed, know how it fits for you, what makes sense for you. You know the pros and cons of claiming later, earlier, etc. And then claim. Don't just pull the trigger frivolously. They estimate, I think the most frivolous trigger pulling are those who just automatically claim at 62 because at the bridge game last week they heard that that's what they should do. Statistics, relying again, there's been a lot of reports on this stuff, a lot of research on this stuff. Over 30% of people who claimed at 62 later regret it. That's a big chunk. Now, two-thirds don't necessarily, or at least won't admit it. So I'm not saying it's absolutely a bad decision. Could be a perfectly good decision in your case to claim as early as possible at 62. But 30%, over 30% regret it. Make sure you're not one of those. The regret is going to come if you make the decision frivolously and pull the trigger. So that's my biggest advice here. I'm not not very specific, but that's the number one thing that I think people need to consider before they go in and claim their benefit. Okay? So if you have any questions on details of what I've spoken about, you'd like me to maybe do a follow-up and dig deeper into some of these elements. I didn't cover every aspect of Social Security. That would take a series of shows. But I'd be happy to do some more deep dives into some stuff. You can send in specific questions to the Q&A show. Best way to do that is go to either our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. There's a contact form you can fill out there. Or you can send emails directly to jim@jimhelps.com. And just make sure in the subject line you write that it's a podcast question. And we get so many Social Security questions in. We do at least one or two Social Security questions each week on the Q&A show. But if I've got a bunch of people that are really interested in one particular aspect, I might do another EDU show follow-up. I know Jim's got some other travel, I think, happening this summer. And I could do another deep dive into some element of Social Security if there's enough interest in it. So I really appreciate everybody listening to the show this week and other weeks. Sorry, it was probably a little mundane having just my voice the entire time. But appreciate you listening, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.